United States that is prepared to help the Iraqi people get what it is they deserve and continue our mission there to take down terrorism from ISIS and others in the region that is in defense of the Iraqi people and is good for America, too.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo speaking to CBS's Face the Nation yesterday, responding to Iraq voting to expel the U.S. military. It's a non-binding vote. And that vote was in response to the U.S. assassination in Baghdad of Iran's top military leader, Qasem Soleimani. So if the U.S. is weakened in Iraq, what does that mean for the fight against ISIS? Already, the U.S.-led coalition fighting ISIS has paused operations as it prepares for Iran's response to Soleimani's killing. Joining us now to help us understand what the future may hold for ISIS is Graham Wood. He's a staff writer at The Atlantic and author of the book The Way of the Strangers, Encounters with the Islamic State. Welcome.
Thank you.
Okay, so what does it mean that the U.S.-led coalition is pausing its operations against ISIS?
I think we first need to note that the operations against ISIS have been going very poorly. So ISIS has been resurgent. It's in a place right now where it was in 2013, 2014. And for the U.S. to take its eye off the ball, so to speak, is not good. But already we were in a terrible position and we were watching ISIS kind of creep back into the Sunni Arab areas of Iraq.
So what does it mean that it's in the same place it was in 2013, 2014? Because didn't it lose a bunch of territory recently after that?
It did. You know, it took territory so quickly in 2015 that we easily forget that in 13, 14, 12, it was greatly reduced organization. You know, ISIS was at that point taking back village by village. It was trying to seize territory when nobody was paying attention. It was just assumed that they were controlling desert territory that nobody really cared about. And of course, we all learned that it was something we should care very much about because they would turn into much more than the rulers of an unwanted desert territory. Now, ISIS has been doing exactly the same thing. The Sunni areas of Iraq, Sunni Arab areas of Iraq, have been watching what's happening in Baghdad and realizing that the government there is Shia, it's sectarian, and that they need a patron. They need someone to count as their protectors. And ISIS has been willing to step in and say, we will protect you if you come to our side. And if you don't come to our side, then we have the power to kill you. So they've been growing in power quietly, slowly. And when it happened last time, they suddenly grew all at once and they couldn't do that again.
Even though their leader killed himself as he was facing a U.S. raid, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, he's dead. And so what's known about his replacement? And is that person as powerful as Baghdadi was?
I don't know. Neither does anyone else. We just should remember, though, again, to analogize to that earlier era, when we saw Baghdadi appear in 2014, it was the first time we'd ever seen him show up in public. So his successor is someone whose identity we don't know. We don't have a picture of him. But if he were to stand in the pulpit in Mosul and appear in high definition for the first time, he would be just like his predecessor, secretive, and then suddenly a person claiming to be speaking for all Muslims worldwide.
Well, how do Muslims in Iraq feel about this?
Well, Muslims everywhere are generally not too keen about ISIS. But the Sunni Arabs in Iraq feel like they have predators at their gate. They feel like Iran wants very much to overrun their territory, and Iran and the militias who Iran sponsors in Iraq do not have a track record of being very kind to Sunnis in that country. So I think it's not so much whether they like the prospect of rule by ISIS, it's whether they fear the prospect of rule by Qasem Soleimani. And of course, they're thrilled that he's dead. Mm-hmm. But it would be much better to have one of their own ruling them, even if ruling them brutally.
So strange indeed that ISIS is cheering the U.S. action against Soleimani.
Yeah, I still watch the remnants of ISIS Twitter, and I see people left and right saying, you know, I love Donald Trump. You know, they're kind of using scare quotes. They're being a little bit ironic, but they really do cheer the death of this man because the Assad regime was an enemy of ISIS in a sense that the Baghdad government was an enemy of ISIS. And these are both clients of Iran. So they're very happy to see one of the people who's been fighting them and who they view as an evil man, an apostate, obliterated.
So who or what is in a state is supporting ISIS?
So ISIS has always had the support of two groups of people. One has been people in its core territory in these Sunni areas of Mesopotamia, who, as I say, need a guardian, need a patron. And then it's had, once it had a foothold, then it had in the broader world the claim that it was a caliphate and that it therefore commanded the loyalty of all Muslims. And then it got a small minority of the 1.6 billion Muslims worldwide to travel to fight for it. So they still have a certain amount of loyalty from that worldwide population, and they're working to have the territorial claim that they eventually were able to get in 2013-14.
So they don't have any covert support from a place like Saudi Arabia, for example?
No, actually quite the opposite. Saudi Arabia sent a lot of its citizens overseas in the sense that they said, all right, you can get out of here because we want you to die. But very, very quickly, ISIS said that Mohammed bin Salman and his predecessors, the rulers of Saudi Arabia, are apostates and we need to fight them. So Saudi Arabia was the victim of numerous ISIS attacks, and they remain really, really high on the hit list. That's not to say that they haven't in the past been kind of ideological bedfellows and supporters of very extreme, intolerant versions of Islam. But ISIS would be the first to say that they would like to see the rulers of Saudi Arabia beheaded as soon as possible.
So what is the grand plan? And what is the grand plan for the United States to fight ISIS in the wake of this assassination? Is there one?
No, there's not any kind of coherent plan. Having U.S. forces in Iraq has at least given us options. You may remember in the period when ISIS was rising in the early 2010s, we had left. We had no options. The most we could do was to summon the Prime Minister, Nouri al-Maliki, to the White House and say, hey, have you noticed that there is a force on your border that's going to take over your second largest city? And then watch him do nothing about it. Now, at least there are a few levers that we could push and pull. The thing is that now we're too distracted. We're too worried that Shia militias are going to target us. So we have now explicitly said we have no time to work on that fight, and we have to make sure that our forces are protected before we go further.
Well, and so what does this vote mean in Iraq yesterday? Because they're actually not taking steps to eject American forces. So is it just a symbolic vote, or will it actually have some teeth in it down the line?
It is just symbolic, yes. And I think we need to note that this is the kind of thing that a parliament can vote on at any point without a lot of discussion and with the full confidence that it's not actually going to turn into policy until it's been filtered through the executive processes of the Iraqi government. So it is a strong statement, of course. There are, you know, most of the Iraqi Arabs are Shia, and some of them have some pretty strong loyalties to their co-religionists from Iran. So they want to state that they were appalled by the assassination of an Iranian on their soil. But no, it doesn't mean that the United States has to go. It means that there is a loud, loud voice within the country that wants to assert that that's their general will for the near future.
Graham Wood from The Atlantic and author of the book, The Way of the Strangers, Encounters with the Islamic State. Graham, thank you.
Thanks very much.
Well, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says she wants to limit President Trump's ability to attack Iran. She says the House will vote later this week on a resolution under the War Powers Act. Well, that resolution would bar Trump from taking further action against Iran after 30 days unless Congress authorizes it. So, who has more power here, Congress or Trump? Jessica Levinson is here to answer that question and a whole lot more. She is our regular Monday Legal and also a law professor at Loyola Law School. Hey there.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. Well, what a New Year it has been. Full of drama. Well, let's start with this planned resolution, Pelosi citing the War Powers Act. passed in the 70s under President Nixon. What does it say?
So it says a lot of things, but essentially what it says is, President, if you want to send armed forces into action, you have to check in with us first, and us meaning Congress. So we either have to have specifically authorized it, there has to be a statute that authorizes it in this situation, or there has to be some sort of national emergency, which includes the U.S. being attacked or foreign members of the army being attacked on foreign soil. It also basically lays out timelines, saying you don't get to have troops in a foreign country for too long. More than 60 days, you have to get reauthorization. You have to check in with us again. So it really is the high point of congressional power when it comes to authority over declaring war. Mm-hmm. It's the moment where Congress says, remember us, we have a role
right.
to play
and
here.
Remember Vietnam. So
exactly.
It happens in the 70s. It's not in a vacuum. Has it been effective?
No, it has not been effective. So if you look at what has happened since 1973, it's been a fairly consistent expansion of executive authority when it comes to declaring war, when it comes to putting our military in action overseas. And why is that? Largely because it's been the Office of Legal Counsel that works for the president who's written memos essentially saying, yeah, okay, you can do that. You can go into Libya, you can go into Syria, you can go into Iraq. And there's a number of different reasons, but they basically boil down to, one, the Constitution vests an enormous amount of power in the executive branch. And two, these little conflicts, they're not quite wars the way the founders would have thought of a war. They're more humanitarian crises or skirmishes. And so there's been, again, a very consistent march of expansion of presidential authority in this area.
Well, speaking of, why is the president the commander in chief? There have been presidents who have lots of military experience, but as of late, including the current president, not a lot of military experience.
So what the founders understood is that the person who's in charge of the military really shouldn't be a body. It should be a person, in the sense that you might have to act quickly. You might not be able to have a deliberation, consensus among a lot of different people. So you would need, some of the writing talks about, a single animated actor who could move quickly. And again, a lot of what the military does isn't necessarily involved in a war. So when it comes to smaller scale issues, you want to have one person who's making the decision, not have to put everything
through. But did the framers envision that that one person might not have any real experience or knowledge of military affairs in such a position of power?
Actually, I think they might have, because if you look at the framers and the documents that they used for reference, so there's a lot of information about what happened in the British Empire, for instance. Mm-hmm. And they also had a system where an executive had power over wars, and where that person didn't always have military experience. Mostly, yes, that was the experience of the founders, but it wasn't a necessary predicate.
And what are the powers of Congress to check that power executive branch?
Congress has the power, the Constitution says, to declare war. This includes raising an army, funding an army. And so Congress really is supposed to act as a very important check against the president when he uses the army for essentially the most important thing that the army can do, which is go to war. And so Congress has allowed its power, not just in this area, in a lot of other areas. They've allowed their power really to go backwards. They've ceded an enormous amount of authority to the president.
Despite the War Powers Act.
Despite the kind of not particularly effectual War Powers Act, which is over 45 years old.
Over the weekend, the president tweeted, and I'm going to read the whole thing. These media posts will serve as notification to the United States Congress that should Iran strike any U.S. person or target, the United States will quickly and fully strike back, and perhaps in a disproportionate manner. Such legal notice is not required, but is given nevertheless! What do you make of that?
Well, that's not actually what the law dictates. What I make of that is that this quote unquote notification is not what the War Powers Act envisions. It's not obviously what the Constitution envisions, even though the Constitution could never have envisioned Twitter. It is more of the march towards the executive taking more authority in this area, but doing so over social media and saying that you're not even required to give that notice, that's not in keeping with mainstream legal thought.
So it's not actually legally viable, is what you're saying.
It's not. But here's the really interesting thing about this area. Who's going to do something about it? I mean, the response from Congress and the response from Nancy Pelosi is, well, we're going to have a resolution trying to take back our authority. So there's essentially no repercussion to the president saying, I'm giving you this notice over Twitter. I'm giving you this notice over social media. And so it's not what the Constitution envisions. It's not what the War Powers Act envisions, but it essentially goes unchecked.
Did the president legally have to authorize or notify Congress that he was considering and going to assassinate Soleimani?
So I think that the safer and better answer is yes, Congress should have been notified. But lawyers could spend a lot of time fighting about whether or not there's an airtight case for that.
Okay, let's turn to another story in the news. A group of Democratic state officials has asked the Supreme Court to weigh in on another case about the constitutionality of Obamacare, and this involves the individual mandate. Tell us about that.
Yes. So back in 2012, when the Supreme Court upheld the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, largely that was based on the idea that the individual mandate, which says individuals have to buy health care, is constitutional because there was a penalty if you didn't buy health care. And what the Supreme Court said is that penalty acts like a tax and Congress has valid tax authority. In 2017, 5 years later, Congress says there's no penalty if you don't buy health insurance. So it basically takes away the underpinning of the reason why the individual mandate was constitutional. There is no penalty, so Congress isn't using its tax power. So where's your constitutional authority for doing this? And so this case has been working its way up and basically up and down the court system. And the Democrats have gone to the Supreme Court and said, we know Republicans are challenging the constitutionality of the individual mandate and the ACA more broadly. We want you to hear this case on an expedited basis. It raises issues of national concern. People are not sure about whether or not they need health insurance, how they should get health insurance. So you need to hear this not next term, but you need to hear it this term.
But why would they do that given the conservative makeup of the court these days?
I think because this is something that's very popular among the American public to have health insurance. And so if it's heard on an expedited basis, the Supreme Court makes a decision by June 2020. That's right when the presidential election is ramping up. That's right when Democrats can use this as a wedge issue to say, look at what's happening in conservative lawmakers challenging the law that you love and then conservative judges overturning the law that you love.
Jessica Levinson, our legal eagle, it's always great to have you.
Thank you.
Happy New Year again. It's going to be a wild and woolly one. Jessica Levinson is a law professor at Loyola Law School. Coming up, Harvey Weinstein faces criminal sexual assault charges in Los Angeles. We'll have the details next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Harvey Weinstein now faces formal criminal charges here in L.A. He's accused of raping one woman and sexually assaulting another in 2013. Here's DA Jackie Lacey today.
In all, eight women came forward to report that they were sexually assaulted by the defendant in Los Angeles County. Three of those alleged crimes took place outside of the statute of limitations. And for that reason, we have declined to file charges in those three cases. We continue to investigate allegations involving three other women to determine if additional criminal charges will be filed.
Lacey's announcement came just as Weinstein's criminal trial began in New York. In that case, Weinstein faces charges from two other women. Former production assistant Mimi Halle and an unnamed woman who says Weinstein raped her in a hotel room also in 2013. Here to tell us more about what to expect from Weinstein's trial is Erin Carmon, senior correspondent for New York Magazine, and she has a new story out in the current issue previewing the trial. Hi, Erin. How are you?
Hi, Madeline. Thank you so much for having me.
Great to have you. Let's begin with the LA charges announced today. Can you give us a few more details about them?
Sure. Well, you know, when we were putting together this story, which included a portfolio of photographs of 21 of the women, we wanted to get a sense of the sheer scope of how many women have come forward. So the number that we came up with in terms of the women who have been public is 100. And then from that, you have more math, such as what we just heard from the DA. How many of those women are making allegations that are criminal as opposed to sexual harassment? How many of those women are willing to cooperate with prosecutors? How many of those women have evidence? And so it's a kind of process of attrition that has gotten us to this point. We may not be done yet. But in New York today, the trial began in the cases of two women, also one charge of rape relating to one woman and sexual assault relating to another. Today, we received this news that there are two already out of LA County, and there may be more. My understanding is that the investigation in London is also ongoing. We're not even at the jury's out stage yet, but I think it has taken years to get to this point. It has taken 100 women, many courageous reporters, a lot of dogged investigation just to get to the point where Harvey Weinstein is being held accountable or being tried in court.
Well, right. So 100 plus women, that sure is a lot. And as you say, it's not all about rape. Some of it is sexual harassment. But still, only four charges filed so far, two in New York, two in L.A., so it seems like there's a pretty high bar for these prosecutors to file criminal assault charges against Harvey Weinstein.
There is. And as you just heard the prosecutor say, some of it is the structure of the law. Some of it is that depending on the level of the offense and the jurisdiction, there is a statute of limitations that says that a case cannot be tried after a certain point. So, for example, Annabella Sciorra says that Harvey Weinstein raped her sometime in the winter of 1993 to 1994. And that is too old under New York law to be tried. But what prosecutors are trying to do is to bring in some of these women whose cases can't be tried on their own to establish a broader case against Weinstein. So in the New York trial, three women who have not been named yet, who accuse Weinstein of assault, and Annabella Sciorra, who has been named, are going to testify as to Harvey Weinstein, what they say is a pattern of predatory behavior. And in particular, Annabella Sciorra's testimony, prosecutors wanted to establish that Harvey Weinstein was a serial predator, which in New York is a criminal charge that can lead to life in prison. And so even though her case can't be tried on its own, prosecutors are kind of making a novel argument here that they successfully got the judge to accept to bring before the jury that the broader pattern, even though it can't be tried separately, is something that the jurors should be aware of beyond just these two women whose cases are being tried in New York. And we don't yet know the full set of facts of the cases that are being brought in Los Angeles, but it'll be interesting to see just how broad the scope of Harvey Weinstein's pattern of behavior will be.
Right.
In many of these stories, we're talking about cases that happened, I believe it's the LA case, the allegations took place within a day of each other.
Right. It was the next, that evening, actually. So in 2013, and so this is similar to what the prosecutors did in the Cosby case, right? That they brought in other women to testify as to a pattern of behavior.
So it's interesting, right? Because law is both objective and subjective when it comes to this. So the objective thing is the statute says you can only bring this kind of charge at this time. But along the way, there are so many subjective decisions that have to do with how our culture reads, you know, what is a crime, who is guilty, what is an alibi, what is it, what is consent? So all of that is shifting and it's subjective. So, for example, in 2015, when a woman went to the NYPD to report that Harvey Weinstein had sexually assaulted her and she agreed to wear a wire, Ambra Batilana Gutierrez, they ultimately decided not to bring charges, in part because they believed that her past made her a not perfect victim. The Bill Cosby case is an example of how just in a few years, the kind of culture change that would lead, one, charges to be brought. So in the Bill Cosby case, a prosecutor had basically backed off years earlier from bringing charges against Bill Cosby. And then two, how the case is brought and what kind of arguments the jury will accept. So in the Cosby trial in 2016, I believe, the first trial ended in a mistrial. He was charged with assaulting one woman, and a second woman testified. The second trial for the exact same charges a year later took place in the middle of a broader cultural conversation about Me Too, about just expanding the understanding of what it means to be a victim. How would a quote-unquote typical victim behave? And five women testified about their own experiences with Cosby that were outside the scope of what the court could try. And that time, Cosby was convicted. So we'll see whether this cumulative effect will be something that the jury will accept. And that's where we really bring in these subjective questions. The jury is going to have to decide. Harvey Weinstein's defense is going to say, look at these text messages, look at these emails. They've said that the woman who alleges rape, that Harvey had a long-term, loving, consensual relationship with her, right? Yeah. She said that this was sexual assault, that this was rape. And so the jury ultimately is going to have to make a really subjective analysis in, you know, what frankly is a very misogynistic society about whether this was a consensual experience or whether it was rape under the law.
I just want to play a clip of tape of what Mimi Halle says happened to her. Just a warning to our listeners, this is a pretty graphic piece of tape, so maybe you have kids in the car, maybe turn the volume down, but here is what she says happened.
When I went upstairs to his apartment, he wasn't wearing a robe at all, but he did start making advances, et cetera, quite, and not too long into me being there. And then he backed me into, I mean, he just wouldn't let it go. I mean, he's very intimidating, also very persistent and forceful, and big physically. So he backed me into a dark room, which looked like, you know, there was kids' drawings on the walls, and didn't seem like a master bedroom or anything. And he held me down, and he forced oral sex on me, basically.
Okay, so is that what is the formal charge for that? What does he face for that if he's convicted?
Sexual assault is the charge in Mimi Halle's case. Mm-hmm. And I think, again, each one of these is going to have to be assessed on its own. But I think ultimately jurors are human and they're going to try to understand each of these charges in the broader context of what they're going to hear.
Right.
Again, the defense is going to say that these were individuals who were seeking employment and who they argue were consenting to sexual activity. Even if it wasn't pretty, it's not rape. That's basically what their argument is going to be. And they plan on presenting emails and text messages from Mimi Halle and the other woman to make the claim that this was consensual. And the prosecutors are going to, or they're at least expected to, bring experts to show that that's a really common reaction to sexual assault, that there is often a normalization attempt on the part of people who have experienced sexual assault, where they want to just pretend like everything is normal and they want to move on with their lives and they don't want to see themselves as victims. And again, this may be a cultural leap for jurors, but that is certainly something that's borne out by expert testimony.
All right. We'll have to leave it there. Irene Carmone, senior correspondent for New York Magazine, thank you so much for coming on today.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Coming up on the program, comedian Ronnie Chang on why America should have an Asian president.
breaking a stereotype of Asian people being meek and submissive, mm-hmm. in the sense that I'm saying, if we take over, we will be better than all of you at this.
Ronnie Chang, next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Comedian Ronnie Chang, probably best known for his role on The Daily Show with Trevor Noah. Here he is back in September.
But Ronnie, Nancy Pelosi today announced the start of a formal impeachment inquiry.
Oh, a formal impeachment inquiry. Oh, why didn't you just say so? Who cares? Even if the Democrats impeach Trump, it'll just go to Mitch McConnell, who's gonna hide it in his neck flaps, and then everyone's gonna argue about it, and then Trump will start a fight with Mariah Carey on Twitter for some reason, and then it's 2020, I've wasted another year and a half of my life again.
Okay, you may remember him also as Cousin Eddie in Crazy Rich Asians.
Russell, thank you so much. It's an honor to be photographed by you.
My pleasure. People will love it in the next Hong Kong Vogue.
Thank you, Russell.
Hong Kong Vogue? I knew it. Your dress is a disaster. If you want a Bottega gown like I told you to, we'd be in the American Vogue.
And he has a new Netflix special out now called Asian Comedian Destroys America.
Like the Chinese name for America is Mei Guo. That directly translates into English as beautiful country. That's the Chinese name for America, beautiful country. That's what we say when you say America in sentences. You say beautiful country. Have you been to a beautiful country? China in Chinese is 中国. That means middle country. It means nothing. We named this place better than we named our own.
Ronnie Chang joins me now from New York. Hi.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. So you do this New York, L.A. thing in your special, but it's not like New York is better or L.A. is better. Everything is.
No, New York is better.
It is.
Come on. You know it.
I do. Well, I used to live in New York. So, yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, you can't say because you're supposed to be impartial and whatever, but you know which city is better in your heart.
Yeah, I do. It's L.A.
Yeah. It's not got L.A. What? Oh.
Okay, we're not going to win this.
We're not going to settle this in this podcast. But.
This is like arguing about religion or politics or something.
We all know the New York NPR office is better. It's where the real work gets done. New York, we're working round the clock. NPRs.
What do you think people are doing in Santa Monica?
In the sun, right? Drinking kombuchas. Eating tacos.
Yeah, that's all true.
We're not eating in New York, okay?
What are you doing?
We got too much stuff. We're doing stuff. We're freaking running to podcasts and yelling into microphones.
Okay, so that kind of dovetails into a bit I wanted to talk about from your special, and that is you talk about how there really should be an Asian president because an Asian president would get things done.
We need an Asian president, man. I'm telling you. Yeah. Man or woman, get that Asian president in the White House. We will fix this in a week. I promise you, give us a solid 8 days, you'll see results. Because we don't care, we just want things to work. Imagine harnessing the power of Asian people in government.
Well, there is an Asian American running for president, Andrew Yang. What do you think about him? Do you like him?
Yeah, I think he's great. I think he's great because he's Asian.
Just because he's Asian? Or
yeah,
do you so like his policies?
I'm a one issue. I can't vote because I'm not American. I'm a one issue supporter. Are you Asian or not? Also known as I'm also known as a racist. I like what he's saying. I think he's, you know, he seems a very pragmatic guy. He's talking about the future a lot. Also, he can't be worse than who's currently in charge. So whoever you vote for is automatically an improvement, right? Might as well go for the Asian guy.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you're just going to vote for Asian people, you're not going to be voting a lot.
Well, thank you. What a backhanded compliment.
I mean, it's just a statement of fact. There aren't a lot of Asian candidates.
Yeah, there should be more.
Yeah. So why aren't
I mean,
there?
Regardless of what happens, how cool is it this guy's running? And imagine all the Asian kids just seeing this, going, oh, yeah, you two could run for president. Yeah.
So is political comedy your thing, pretty much?
No.
Not at all?
No. I mean, it definitely wasn't my thing before I got to The Daily Show. But I think working in that kind of environment every day, it can't help but rub off on you a little bit. But my focus is on comedy that I think is funny and is saying the thing that I want to say. My job is to find funny jokes, and the added layer to become a great stand-up comic is saying things that you want to say, being authentic with yourself, I think. You know what I mean? Meaning, it's not just about making people laugh. That's definitely a large part of the skill. Then the second part, the next level comes when you're making people laugh for the reasons that you want them to laugh, you being myself. So a lot, one thing we talk about at The Daily Show a lot is, what are you trying to say? What are you trying to say with this joke? Meaning, this joke is funny. Oh, that's a really funny punchline. But what are you trying to say with it? And if what you're trying to say matches what you what you're trying to say, then great, right? Because you don't want people laughing for the wrong reasons.
Yeah.
Basically, yeah.
So in general, what are you trying to say?
In general, man, what a broad question. What am I trying to say? I'm trying to say that New York is better than LA. I'm trying to say that. I think I'm trying to portray Asian perspectives with nuance, dignity, sophistication.
Well, I guess I'm wondering, when I listen to that little bit about, you know, Asian president can fix something in a week, that kind of plays into the stereotypes of Asians just being worker bees and not, and you know, which is not necessarily a positive stereotype.
I guess you could also see it as breaking a stereotype of Asian people being meek and submissive. In the sense that I'm saying, if we take over, we will be better than all of you at this. And not to mention the fact that I'm the one who's saying it. It's not some white person saying this. I'm the one saying this. So, I mean, you did also say that there's not a lot of Asian people running.
Yeah.
So, kind of like asking people, Asian people, to run and take over the country through democracy is kind of playing against stereotype in a way as well, right?
Yeah. Why aren't there more Asian people in politics or running for office?
If you're a first generation immigrant, in my opinion, when we come to America and we decide to stay because we like it, when we face institutional roadblocks, our instinct is to just work around it. So we're not here to change the system. We're here to, you know, thrive within the system. You know what I mean? Because in a very general sense, the reason we're here is because we appreciate this system more than whatever system we came from. So we're not here to revolutionize the system. We're here to navigate that system and hopefully succeed in that system. So I think a lot of first-generation immigrants won't run because of that reason, right? That being said, I'm speaking very generally here. I'm sure there's I just read some stories about how a lot of first-generation female immigrants are actually running for office, like local councils and stuff, and winning. So, which leads me to another thought that maybe, again, immigrants are the ones who want to do the jobs that no one wants to do, in this case, being a local elected official.
So why did you choose to come here? You've been here for 4 years. Money.
Yeah. Money, the capital of capitalism. Well, I came here because this is the biggest platform for storytelling. I mean, I think in my job is essentially storytelling, right? I'm in the business of telling stories. The storytelling America, in my opinion, is the most cutting edge. It's the most contemporary. I think everything here skews very young, sometimes to its own detriment in America. But a lot of the time, it means that everything done here is very innovative and cutting edge. And with storytelling, I think that's essential. So I came here because all my comedy heroes came from here. There's the biggest platforms came from here. Name it. It came from here.
And then how did you get on The Daily Show? How did that happen?
I got invited to the Montreal Just for Laughs Comedy Festival in 2013. And I did the Eddie Izzard Gala with Trevor Noah. And then in 2015, through a production company, he asked me to audition for A Daily Show.
And voila.
And I found out later, he basically pushed for me to get on. He was just trying to give a platform to an Asian person. You know, it's half the world. He wanted that part of the world represented. I'm very lucky he chose me. You know, he probably had closer friends and funnier friends he could have put on the show, but he wanted to give Asian people a platform to discuss things. And I'm lucky that I was just the conduit for it.
And your character is a pretty angry guy, pretty dyspeptic. Is that your off-screen
I think there's definitely a lot of truth in that character. I've been described by bad British reviewers as a misanthrope. I think I'm generally a pretty grouchy person. I'm a little bit of a loner. I'm kind of used to being a loner, so I'd rather be alone than hang out with people who irritate me. I don't know if that makes me a weirdo, but that's just...
Or just honest, really.
Maybe I'm just honest, yeah. In my opinion, you know, there's different types of comedy, obviously, but what I think kind of makes great stand-up comedy, you can play a character, you can be a one-liner, and be great at that, obviously. I'm just saying, one way to become great at stand-up comedy, I think, is to be very authentic and find your voice and be very true to that voice. You
know? So, yeah. And that's an angry voice in your
case.
Well, I want to thank you so much for coming on today.
Oh, what? Oh, okay, cool. You know what? If you just watch my special, that's really what this is about.
That's true. I mean, you do want to make money after all.
I'm just trying to make some money here, guys. I'm just an immigrant for a dream here. Help me fulfill my dream by watching my special so it can help me in my next contract negotiation. Just increase the view. In fact, don't even watch it. Just turn it on and mute it.
Yeah, there
just,
you go.
You playing in the background helps the view count. So do a good thing tonight. Just put it on and go to sleep. Don't even watch it.
At least you're being honest.
Dude, that's all we have.
Ronnie Chang, he's on The Daily Show and his new special. It's on Netflix. It's called Asian Comedian Destroys America. Ronnie, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, we remember the quintessential LA artist, John Baldessari, next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Let's end the show today by remembering a major contributor to LA's contemporary art scene. John Baldessari died in his Venice home last Thursday. He was 88 years old, and he was a major figure in conceptual art. His work has been seen in hundreds of solo exhibitions worldwide. One of his most famous moves was to burn more than a decade's worth of his own work to create a new piece. With me now to talk about him and the mark he left on Los Angeles is Carolina Miranda. She covers art and culture for the LA Times, and she's a regular here at Press Play. Hey there.
Hello.
Well, tell us more about why he was such a towering figure, and towering literally. He was very, very tall, but he towered over the art scene here. Why?
Yeah, he was 6'7", just in case anybody wants to know. And towering in so many ways. I think, one, because he was an incredibly influential artist. He became one of the early, very prominent voices in conceptual art in the 1960s. And so that is art that is less about making a painting or making a sculpture, but instead making a statement, putting forth an idea and using whatever materials necessary to sort of carry out that idea. And he was incredibly good at that. He was also a renowned teacher, taught at Cal Arts for much of his career, has this laundry list of famous artists that were also his students, figures like Mike Kelly and Jim Shaw and Analia Saban. So this is someone who was as influential in the gallery as he was as a teacher, and was also widely regarded as this rather gentle soul, very encouraging, the type of figure that encouraged experimentation, and so very beloved within both of those scenes.
Mm. And he was also on the board at MoCA, and he was intimately connected with LACMA, so also involved in the city's major cultural institutions.
Absolutely. I think John Baldessari is one of the reasons that people are talking about an LA art scene these days so much. And his thumbprint is all over LACMA. He designed their logo. He designed some of their conference room spaces. You go into their employee conference room in their office, and you had this topsy-turvy room that had freeways on the ceiling and clouds on the floor. If you are searching for something on the LACMA website and you get an error, the 404 error that comes up is a John Baldessari Baldessari painting that says wrong. And so someone who was, you know, an important exhibitor, but also an important proponent of what was being done in Los Angeles at a time when everybody was making fun in Los Angeles, you know, when the only culture here was the yogurt, you know.
Right. So talk about some of his best known projects.
Well, I think the piece that he did in the 1960s where he burned all of his works is certainly one of his most famous works. I think one, he is known for a number of things. One is a series of paintings that he did in the 1960s in which he hired a sign painter to create these paintings that riffed on the nature of art. So how to make art that sells and, you know, all these rules that kind of make no sense and are ridiculous, but painted in this very sort of professional sign painter style that questions, you know, what is art. He did, starting in the 80s, he worked a lot with found photography, movie stills, collaging them, cutting them up, painting over pieces of them and assembling them in really curious and dynamic ways. I think for me, one of the pieces that gets most at who he was in terms of capturing that humor, but also that cutting sense of observation, was this 1969 piece called Ghetto Boundary Project, in which he printed up 2,000 stickers that said boundary and then stuck them around the area around National City where he was from, questioning what is a ghetto, what is a boundary, what separates a ghetto from something that is not a ghetto. And so it's this piece that is a work of street art. It's a work of, you know, urban intervention. He's questioning how we divide our cities. And it's also just this humorous cutting piece of conceptual art.
So he, as you say, began as a painter and became a conceptual artist. Tell us more about how he came to be. Where was he from? How did he become an artist?
Well, he has an interesting story, and it's a very California story. He was born in National City. He's the son of European immigrants. His father was from Austria in the area near Italy. They spoke Italian, and very humble background. You know, National City is not exactly known as a hotbed of art making. It's situated right between San Diego and the Tijuana border. But, you know, this is someone who was always intrigued by his father worked in salvage, and so this idea of finding objects, taking them, giving them new life in some other way was something that always appealed to him, and that was something that I think served as an impetus for his art making. You know, taking, for example, these booklets about how to make art and repurposing them into paintings, taking film stills and repurposing them into collage. I think a lot of that was born in his own childhood and his own early education in terms of, you know, working with what you have.
Right. And so what you're describing is someone who was full of boundless energy, it seems. Like he was creating art up until he died.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he was working on projects. We had an interview run with him in the LA Times, I believe it was last year, and he had something like five projects in the works. And, you know, this was someone who just was incredibly restless, you know, started as a painter, incinerated his paintings as an artistic act, became known as a conceptual artist in the 80s, then turned to working with found photographs. So you can link his work in with this whole pictures generation of artists who were working with images in the 1980s. And in a way that was very prescient, you know, the idea of the image and text, I mean, that is basically the internet now. Yeah. Is an image with text over it. And he was doing that, you know, in the 60s and 70s and 80s when it was much harder to do than just going to Imgur and slapping a saying on an image, and then, you know, creating sculptural pieces. He did a whole series, I believe it was in the 90s or early 2000s, of these disembodied pieces of human body. So it might be you walk into a gallery and you see this very sculptural representation of an ear or a nose. And so always pushing the boundaries, not just of art, but even his own work. And I think, you know, one of the things he always used to say about what inspired him is that he was always looking in the in-between spaces. What is it that everyone else is ignoring? That's where he went.
Oh, so interesting. And what a great way to begin the new year, you know, to have that in our minds to look at the in-between spaces and to look at things a little differently than what you see right in front of your face. Carolina Miranda covers art and culture for the LA Times. We were remembering John Baldessari, who died last week. He was 88 years old. Carolina, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
And that'll do it for us today. Don't forget, you can download or subscribe to our podcast and listen whenever, wherever you want at kcrw.com/pressplay. I'm Madeline Bram. I'll see you tomorrow.